Hey guys, Ron Placone here. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians. Got a fun episode for you today. Brett Detter, musician, my guest. He's done a lot of different things. He's a successful film composer. And he played in the band The Juliana Theory, which is a band that I listened to a lot, that I would go and see a lot in the music scene that both Brett and myself grew up in. And I remember we found out off mic I was at the first opening show that they got on a national tour. I was at that show and I saw them open up for a band called Sensefield. And I went to pretty much almost every show they had since. I definitely missed some, but I was at almost every Juliana Theory show from about, I want to say, 99 to like 2002-ish, maybe. And we talk about all that, and what's really cool is that the Juliana Theory is getting back together to do some shows, because it is their 20th anniversary as a band. So it was cool to talk to Brett, it was cool to hear about what's going on with the reunion shows, and I'm looking forward to seeing it. And we talked about life, and art, and breakups, and what they're like, and the ending of an artistic endeavor, you know. I mean, he talks about how the band broke up, how he felt. We get into his story, and you know, it's kind of applicable, I think, to life in general. When just a chapter closes and another one opens, and what to do in between when you're really not sure what's on the horizon. So we're gonna get right into it. A little bit of housekeeping. Monday, May 8th is my next music show. I'm gonna be playing at the Old Town Pub in Pasadena. It's in the Los Angeles area, Old Town Pub, 8 p.m. No cover on that one, just so you know. And I'm going to be playing some of my favorite tunes, going to be telling some stories, going to be talking about the show and some of the guests on the show, going to be doing a little bit of anecdotes, pretty much all covers in the set this time around. You know what? Some of my musician friends show up to this thing, and we're at the last one at least, and that's a mix of very flattering and also makes me a little bit unsure of things, because I think I know that I'm not really a musician, and I think they, of all people, they really know that I have no business being up here in this capacity. But it seemed to be, people seem to enjoy it. So hopefully that remains the case. I'm looking forward to this next one. The first one, I had a blast. It seems like everybody that was there enjoyed themselves, so I'm doing it again. That is Monday, May 8th, 8 p.m., Old Town Pub in Pasadena, ronplacone.com for all the latest updates and tour dates that are going on, as stand-up dates, Jimmy Dore Show live dates, other random performances I do, like a music show that I do every so often. It's all on my website. It's all going on. Without further ado, we're going to get to Brett Detter. I'm Ron Placone. You're listening to the Indie Bohemians. Yeah, I've probably seen your band like 12 or 13 times, that's amazing. It's not like that's a situation where you'd ever say your last name. Like, you're not gonna be like, I'm Brett Detter.
Yes.
And this is the Juliana Theory.
Yeah, exactly.
It's just the Juliana Theory.
We never really did that thing where, you know, bands get up on stage and they'll be like, and ladies and gentlemen, on drums, Josh Walters. And you turn around and he does this 2-minute drum fill, you know, it's like.
Yeah, that was never really that was never really going on in the scene back in those days.
I always would. You watch bands and they do that, and you'd be like, "That's kind of awful and kind of awesome at the same time."
Exactly,
it's amazing and really. I think I've done it like 2 times, just being like, I don't know why.
In the Juliana Theory,
yeah, like okay, like well, they didn't do anything. Like they didn't actually like do any like play any cool licks or anything. But I think there was one or two times where I introduced the band, quote unquote, just for. I don't know, something to do.
So I'm Ron Placone, you're listening to the Indie Bohemians, and I am joined by Brett Detter, who played in the Juliana Theory, a band that I have seen, probably, like I mentioned. Yeah, definitely, I don't know if 13 is the exact number, that's an estimate. But yeah, man, I think from, what would it have been year-wise, like probably 99-ish to 2003 or so, there weren't many Laga shows, Club Laga shows, that I wasn't in attendance. For all of our Pittsburgh listeners, you'll probably hear some references this week, because that is the homeland of both Brett and I.
Yes.
And now we're both here in LA. It's weird how that happened. You know, I had a friend that I grew up with that coincidentally enough lived probably the same distance from me in Silver Lake I first moved to town. Yeah, yeah, yeah. I moved to Silver Lake and he saw a video I did randomly where I mentioned that I live in Silver Lake and he messaged me. He's like, do you really live in Silver Lake? Because I live in Silver Lake. And we like grew up together and we're like good buddies, went to high school together, whatever, and then kind of, you know, went apart, drifted away, and then reconnected 3,000 miles apart, or 3,000 miles away, but like down the street.
It's strange how that happens. My aunt was telling me recently that she went on this vacation to somewhere in South America. She, you know, I don't know, 2,000 miles away from her house. And they're sitting on the beach and she's like talking to the person sitting on the beach next to them. And they're like, oh, da, 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 we're from Pennsylvania. And then the people beside them, oh, we are too. Oh, what town are you from? And it ended up, and I'm not kidding you, they're absolute next door neighbors. And they've been next door neighbors for 15 years. I'm talking house next to house. And they've never once met each other until they were in. Like 2,000 miles away, and they were sitting right next to each other on a beach, but they had never met. Man. It's crazy how that works.
I've never heard anything that trippy. The trippiest, like, Pennsylvania thing I have, and this isn't all that, but you might like this. I was at just a Steelers bar, like, one of my friends wanted to go, like, just, oh, let's watch a Steeler game at, like, and it was, like, super, it was in Hollywood, but it was, like, super Pittsburgh-y. Like, they had, like, this dude that was, like, from the Strip District, and he told everybody that. He was like, I gotta mention this. And he actually had stuff shipped that he auctioned off.
Wow.
So it was, like, sauces from, like, Permanis or whatever. It was a little over the top. But there was this dude in an Addict Records t-shirt.
Yeah, that's awesome.
And I was like, nice t-shirt, dude. And he was like, I guess you're from there. And it's like, well, yeah, but yeah. I might not. I mean, that record store is known across the country. True. That and Jerry's, they're known everywhere.
Legendary.
Yeah, like they are. And deservedly so, man. That's a random quirk about Pittsburgh. They got some killer record stores.
That is true.
But I was like, well, I am. And then anyway, we found out we grew up in the same neighborhood and our grandparents were friends.
That's amazing.
Like I didn't know him though, and he didn't know me. Like we didn't go to the same high school. But anyway, man, let's talk about you and the Giuliana Theory is going to be doing some shows, and it's the reunion of the Emotion Is Dead album, right?
That's not even the reunion of the Emotion Is Dead album. Not to correct you, but it's
no, that's fine. By all means, please.
We're literally doing. We realized, well, what happened was we've been getting offers for a few years to come back and play shows. And I just kept saying, no, we don't need to, you know, we don't need to play any more shows. Like we said that we weren't going to play anymore. And slowly but surely, all the guys in the band kept calling me, but like, Brett, why don't we do something else? Why don't we play some more shows? And last summer, Josh Fiedler said, you know, 2017 is the band's 20-year anniversary. And I said, no way, no, it's not. And he's like, yes, it is. And I was like, you're right. It's been 20 years. That's totally crazy. So that's kind of when we realized, well, maybe we reconsider this not playing any more shows and like do a, you know, 20-year anniversary because it seemed like that could be a fun
thing. So it's of the band as a whole.
Yes, it's the band's 20-year anniversary. We started in 97 in a garage.
That's amazing, yeah, man. Congratulations.
It's totally crazy to me that we're gonna play shows at the, like 20 years after we started, but it's also crazy that it's been 20 years because a lot of times it feels, you know, feels totally a lot less than that. But
yeah, totally, man. Happens. So well, let's talk some about the history of the band, and then of course I want to get some of your post theory story because cool. I don't, you know, I mean, it's like I found you on social media, saw the theory was getting back together, and I was like, that's awesome. But you know, I wasn't too keen on what you've been up to since, and I'm sure it's been a lot. But so I remember your guys' first album, and then I remember when Emotion Is Dead came out, and I remember liking it a bunch. And I also remember at the time the scene was very you know, kind of like there were a lot of rules. It seemed like there were a lot of bands, and then you guys kind of were one of the bands, and you weren't the only band, but you were among the bands that kind of went outside the box and was like, yeah, we like pop punk. We like doing this. We use octaves, but we like Peter Gabriel. We like classic rock. Sure. We're gonna show some of our lead guitar chops on this album. We're going to use some loops, some experimental stuff. And I've always been curious from your perspective, like, it sounded like there was some backlash from that, but the attendance at the shows kept getting bigger and bigger. So what was that kind of like from your perspective? Like, what was the backlash like? Or was there a lot or just a little bit? And then, you know, what was it like to then, on the other side of that, seeing, well, people are digging it?
It was interesting because I think, like, on our first record, we didn't really... There was no pressure in any way, shape, or form. Nobody knew who we were. All the first fans we probably ever got were, oh, this is Brett, the guitar player for Zao, the metal band's side project that he sings in, this poppy thing. And a couple people would come to see us based on that, but there was really no expectation of anything. And so I think when we made Emotion Is Dead and definitely tried to expand our sound and, you know, like you said, try a bunch of different things, we definitely immediately saw a lot more people coming to shows, and seemed like the band had hit another, you know, step of, I don't know, like just a larger audience. But yeah, at the same time, there was a certain level of like punk rock politics that we might not have necessarily been keen to understanding, and probably felt a little bit of you know, just a backlash to certain things we were doing, because certain things we were doing, we embraced pop music in a very like overt way. We weren't afraid to just try to write big hooks or to try to put on a show that was a little bit more over the top than a lot of like punk rock per se kind of bands were doing. And I think that rubbed a couple people the wrong way. Most fans were totally into it and loved it, had a great time at the shows and thought it was awesome. But there was definitely a little bit of like, you know, the intelligentsia, the super ultra cool kids that were like, oh, who's this?
I like the old album better.
Who's this band think they are? They're like, you know, why are they the emo boy band? You know, because we had hooks, like big melodies and things like that. So there
you know
was a
what?
Little bit of that.
I was dating this girl in high school for a hot minute, and I wrote her this poem that I told her I wrote, but it was Music Box Superhero. And so I apologize. You know what? I just remembered that.
No,
and,
don't
and
apologize.
Like,
that's
that
amazing.
Not, yeah, I was just like, this is how I feel. And I didn't bother mentioning that, like, oh, this is totally something that somebody else wrote.
In all honesty,
it was my own.
We're very, I'm proud to have been used in such a way.
You know? Yeah, well, I owe you a beer or something.
Oh, good. Thank you. That's
but,
awesome.
So, well, did you ever feel like maybe, like, did you ever feel a little bit I mean, you mentioned off mic that you guys didn't do, most of your tours were just headline tours.
Yeah.
Because you weren't able to get a lot of support tours, and it seemed like, I mean, obviously you guys weren't in the hardcore world that Zao was in, but you were probably accepted in part of that world, but you also weren't quite in the, you know, pop punk, newfound glory world.
True.
Either. You were kind of sort of in both those worlds, but not really in neither. Did you ever feel disconnected, or did you kind of embrace it, or what was that like?
We kind of felt like bastard children, period. Like,
okay.
At all times. I think we always, you know, like you said, we had friends in other bands, and we were definitely embraced to a degree in the hardcore scene. I know we would play things like Hellfest, and we would play, like, you know, a lot of shows with really heavy bands, whether it was like Coalesce or me doing double duty in Zao, things like that. And I, you know, I remember, like, back in the day showing up to like Hellfest and Crazy Fest and seeing like guys in bands like 18 Visions wearing Juliana Theory t-shirts, and me being like, well, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
Never really would have expected that. And so we definitely had this weird cross-pollinization of kids that were into heavy music that liked us because of the association, but at the same time, like you said, we were playing with like pop punk bands or playing with emo bands, and always felt a little bit like we didn't necessarily fit into any of those worlds. And then I remember like taking, really just trying to take like guitar rock bands on tour. Like, I remember taking a couple bands on tour that didn't fit in the scene at all, and thinking like, oh, this is something our fans will dig. And I also remember our fans just basically sitting there and like not giving any reaction to
really?
Like those bands too. So it was always like this weird, because we were at one point, because we came up in a scene, we were somewhat embraced by that scene, but at the same time, we were always kind of trying to not be pigeonholed, and we were trying not to be, you know, too much a part of anything except what we wanted to do. And so along with that comes, you know, that there's, yeah, like, you know, you think about anything that's a scene, and you think about the fact that it's a group of people that are kind of all together united under a certain banner. And whenever you're right along with everybody else under that banner, you feel very included. But as soon as you kind of try to break out and do something a little bit different or a lot different, you're the weird person that's not necessarily fitting in with the clique. So we were guilty of, like, I guess doing both, like being a part of a scene, but then also not wanting to be a part of it and rebelling against it, getting bored by it and, you know, feeling pigeonholed by it. And then at the same time, having, like you said, not necessarily feeling like we were part of a certain group of people, having, like, things like having bands that we were friends with, that we toured with, go later on and tell, like, you know, tell a record label that we made the wrong record, like, you know, the record after Emotions Dead. Like,
other bands did that?
We had a couple, like, bands that we were good friends with that we found out after the fact. They were a couple bands, I'm not going to name names, but that their sound always stayed very the same from record to record. They just kind of embraced their thing, and then they stuck with it, which I totally get, and I totally respect when people did that. But,
well, that's kind of like the AC/DC theory, right? It's like AC/DC made the same album for 20 years. That's what we're going to do.
Right.
And then, but then there's other bands that are like, no, we're going to make our Born to Run now. We're going to make our London Calling
now. Of course,
now.
Of course.
And it's like, I don't, you know, I mean, I'm not a musician, so I don't know how that call is made, or if there's different perspectives in the band, how you make that decision. Like, I have no clue.
I think that, yeah, I really feel like there's just different mentality in general. And some, like you said, like AC/DC or whatever, bands are just awesome that are just doing their one thing. But then, like, Refused decides to come out with The Shape of Punk to Come. And I'm sure at the beginning, some people were like, I remember, like, reading reviews at that point in time with a couple of people being like, this is complete garbage. This sucks. This isn't punk or whatever. But I think you just kind of have to, you know, follow your inner muse, whatever that tells you to do. But yeah, you can get in trouble politically if you break too hard with a group of people that accept you, but you just have to, we just never cared. We just didn't care if people in bands didn't like what we did or did like it. We just knew what we wanted to try, and we did it.
Well, how did the Pittsburgh music scene kind of play into all that?
In a way, the Pittsburgh music scene was, it's weird because we weren't very involved with the Pittsburgh music scene, but we certainly had friends in Pittsburgh bands for sure, whether it's Punchline or, you know, bands like, I mean, I remember our first show ever, we borrowed equipment from the Berlin Project. There's definitely, like, Pittsburgh bands, it's weird because we toured so much that we weren't home very much, so we actually didn't hang out a lot, and when we were home, we were usually writing and recording and rehearsing, and we weren't that social. We didn't really hang out a lot. But before the Juliana Theory, in Greensburg and Latrobe, there was this crazy active music scene. And that's where we all came up in. All of us came up in that scene. And we all played in other bands.
Is that like when, like, the CD Warehouse was still really active?
It was even before that.
Oh, wow. Okay.
There was this club called Illusions in Latrobe where, like, back in the day, Black Flag had come through there and played. Wow. And it was, like, this legendary, weird all-ages club. And so a lot of us started out playing. I played my first show on, I think, Valentine's Day there. And I was 16 years old. And it was, like, this all-ages club. And it had a stage. And it had, like, a light show and fog machine and everything. But you could go see bands, you know, before you're 21. And so that's where everybody in the Juliana Theory and all the Zao guys too, we all came up, like, in that world. So we all came up playing shows all the time. And there was a little coffee shop in Greensburg called the Teatro Cafe where a lot of the bands just like would hang out every night and talk about records and listen to music, and then bands would play there, and it really was the tiniest little room. But mm-hmm. that's like just kind of, so it was like an offshoot of the Pittsburgh scene. We would go to Pittsburgh and we would go see shows in Pittsburgh. We'd go to Metropole and and see Fugazi or whatever, but we actually had our own self-contained little Western PA music scene of all these different bands that sounded totally unlike one another, but we all got along and played shows together, and that's really like where everything started for me and for all of us.
That's funny you bring up Fugazi, because I remember, do you remember the year that Fugazi played the tech fair that Carnegie Mellon University does?
I went to it. I was there.
Were you there?
Yes.
Okay, so that same day, it was like an afternoon thing.
Mm-hmm.
That same day, my cousin was getting married at like one of the churches down mm-hmm. like in Oakland. So I remember being like, I'm gonna miss the Fugazi show. And I mean, obviously it was like, family's first, whatever, I can't miss my cousin's wedding. But like, I'll never forget, I was like outside as like the bridal party or whatever was entering the church, and I could hear the guitars.
Oh my God.
And I knew that was Fugazi warming up, and I was just, I was in high school or whatever, and I was just like dying slowly. Wow. And I was like, they'll be back. And then of course, like 2 years later, hiatus indefinitely. Yeah. And I was like, no. So like, I've never seen Ian MacKaye do anything live. I would go see his duo just because it's like, it's him.
Right.
I've never gotten to see Fugazi.
That's my very first show. Not that one,
no
but
kidding.
Seeing Fugazi was my first, like, I mean, not
in
my
Greensburg?
First. No, in Pittsburgh, at Metropole, but that was my first. I'd seen lots and lots of like local band shows from that scene I was talking about, but my first like real show from a national act that mm-hmm. was Fugazi.
Just your first punk show or your first like show period?
I guess I saw Rush play in an arena mm-hmm. before that, maybe by a month or two. That's just a totally different experience than seeing Fugazi in front of 2,000 people when I'm down in the mosh pit, you know, as opposed to seeing Rush and I'm standing like 4,000 feet from the stage in this, giant arena. So,
Oh yeah, man. I mean, it went like, cause that was how it was for me. Like I would go, like I saw a lot of classic rock stuff with my parents, and I still love that stuff. I still celebrate all that. My first concert was Traffic when I was 8.
Oh wow.
And then I saw Elton John a couple years later, and I loved it, cause I was a big Elton John fan growing up. And, but then I saw Rancid at Metropole, and I was like, oh, this is something different.
Totally.
And holy, this is exciting.
Yeah.
Then let's jump to the band and some of these shows, and then I want to kind of get into you. So what is it going to be like when you're determining a set list and determining, like, because it's been 20 years, the band, it was 2006 you guys broke up, right?
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So it's been a little while. You guys have all done different things. And so when you go to sit down, like what's kind of going through your head? I mean, do you think, will the band agree on material, or are there any albums you want to highlight more than others? Is there anything you'd rather not revisit?
We've definitely kind of come to an agreement on what we want to do. And I guess we got really data driven this time around and got really nerd level, but we went on Spotify, iTunes, Apple Music, YouTube, Last.fm, everywhere, and just kind of like compiled the most favorited, like most played songs, and we're literally just building our set list completely from that. So it's not really even necessarily 100% what would the band want to play. We're just thinking like, what do we know our audience wants to see? And that's literally how we're picking our set list, based on those songs.
Perfect.
So we've never done that before, and we kind of realized in the past that we would, you put a new record out, you focus on that record, you play the songs from that record, and maybe some people want to hear certain fan favorites and you throw a few in. But we just kind of realized, well, this is like 20-year anniversary and you're celebrating the history of the band or whatever. And obviously we haven't made a new record in a long time, so it makes sense to just play the songs that people want to hear the most. And why not? Make people happy. Have fun.
Yeah. So walk me through your post-Juliana Theory life, man.
My post-Juliana Theory life? Well, I'll tell you, the beginning was, the first little while was pretty weird, because I graduated high school and pretty much went on tour full-time
mm-hmm.
and did that for...
Did your parents approve?
At first, I think at the beginning, because the first tour I did was with Zayo, and I don't know if they didn't exactly love the sound of the band with, like, you know, demon sounding cackling vocals, you mm-hmm. know, like we were practicing in their basement and they're like, would you please shut the doors, the neighbors are terrified, you know. I don't think they totally loved that, but no, they were always super supportive. And in fact, my parents basically were like the band parents. My mom did most of our, like, paperwork for all our, you know, expenses after tour or whatever.
Oh wow.
We practice in, we always almost always practice in my parents' basement. My dad built us a shed that was like our merch and road case shed.
Oh wow.
My dad helped us build like a couple like trailer loft things in like this pimped out van. We bought this, like, what is it, like a big like airport shuttle, and we like totally pimped it out with bunks and like a big like TV and video game system and all the stuff. My dad basically did most of the work for it. Like,
wow.
So my parents were incredibly supportive. But yeah, at that point, you know how it is. Like, parents probably want their kid to take a more traditional approach to going out and going to school and getting a steady job where you're not relying upon yourself to make a living or whatever. But yeah, anyways, I think when the band broke up, there's definitely that feeling of you've been on a roller coaster for 10 years, or you've been on, I always said it's like being in a pirate ship, because when you're on tour, it's like us against the world, and you got these dudes that you would do anything for and that would do anything for you. You fight, you get in fights because of these dudes, you know, you're writing songs together, you're living together. It's like a giant marriage. And so suddenly not be on tour, to not be writing a new record, to not be seeing those guys, because I moved away too, there was like a good year or so where I just literally didn't know what to do with myself. Not because, well, yeah, I guess I just didn't know what to do with myself, because that had been my whole life up until that point. And so I went through a couple year period where I felt a complete loss of confidence in my songwriting ability and in my ability as a singer and a musician. And I just totally quit music completely. And me and my lady started an online vintage clothing store. And I was like, I'm not a musician. We moved to LA. And I somehow started hanging out with all these musicians, probably just because I gravitate to those kind of people, because I, you know, they're my friends. But I just didn't even talk about the fact that I was in a band or whatever, and a lot of them didn't even know. And I just remember trying to divorce myself from that world completely and saying, I'm done. I'm not a songwriter anymore. And I kind of did it for about 3 years. I didn't really do much, except the problem was that I kept writing songs on accident. But mm-hmm. I had this little like digital recorder and I would keep with me. And if I get a song idea, I would hurry up and record it on this thing, but then I would never listen back, and I never made any plans to, like, well, what could I do? Should I make a record, or should I, you know, I didn't think about any of that stuff. I just had this little digital recorder. And I remember a couple of years later, after I was living in LA for a couple of years, and I...
Yeah, did you come to LA first?
Yeah, I came to LA about a year after the band broke up. And so I kind of had this, like, tape recorder thing, and I listened back one day, and I was like, oh, wow. I have a lot of songs on here. A lot of them are pretty good, or at least I thought so. And I guess that's when I first came to the realization that I might have a solo record. And I never really wanted to do that, because I just wasn't really interested in, like, band breaks up, lead singer starts a solo career. Mm-hmm. Like, that just never really felt like my vibe. And I was definitely completely burnt out on rock and roll, on distorted guitars, on, you know, big rock music.
Okay.
And I'd become completely obsessed with, like, old school country music and folk music, stuff like, you know, Johnny Cash and Townes Van Zandt and Guy Clark, Lynn, all that kind of stuff. And, you know, I went through, it was probably a long period of time where that's all I listened to. And so I basically realized that I had a record on this digital recorder, and I ended up going to Nashville and mm-hmm. made a solo record called Bird in the Tangle, which was by far the most candid record I had ever made. It was just super honest about it. Was a lot of the songs were about like not believing in myself or thinking that I, you know, quitting what I loved, and you know, feeling, because I moved away from all my friends, everybody that I knew, and I sort of felt alienated, and I felt like, you know, I failed the band in a way. And so I went through a long period of self-doubt, and all those songs kind of came from that. So it's a heavy listen, but I think like there's some really good songwriting on it, but it's definitely like a dark, you know, dark record. And so that kind of happened, and I put that album out, and I guess at about around the same time we went, about that same time, Theory got back together and did the 10-year Emotion is Dead anniversary tour, which was really fun. But that was like 6 shows, I think, we did in 2010. And that was actually a really healing thing, because mm-hmm. at that point, there were a couple guys in the band that I wasn't really talking to and that weren't talking to me. And I thought a couple guys might be mad at me and thought we kind of had like a falling out. Not because anything major ever happened, because nothing major ever did happen, but just I really felt so let down by myself and by the music world to a certain degree, by the way that the band ended, that I just kind of like divorced myself from where I lived and kind of like stopped talking to a lot of people just because I went into a shell, I guess, and it was just good.
But
to
why
do
did
those.
You? I mean, obviously this is a very complicated question. You don't have to like go into all of it. Sure. But why did you kind of put that on yourself, and like what made you guys kind of realize, okay, this ride is over?
Well, I'll say this much. Spinal Tap's one of my favorite movies of all time. And if that movie is on TV, I can't turn it off no matter what. But I think a little bit probably because I relate to Spinal Tap in a way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Think about that whole movie is about this band who kind of like hit their peak at a certain time period, and then they're on this ride down from their peak. It's like on this, it's on the backside of their success, and like, you know, seeing the being in the hotel lobby and seeing somebody they used to tour with, and that guy being like, you know, I'm playing the Enormo Dome tonight or whatever, mm-hmm. and you know you're playing some little dive down the street or whatever. And I think that a lot of the last couple of years of the band felt to me like I just felt like I was living in Spinal Tap. And so that's part of the reason I feel like we could have continued and kept going, and we still got along extremely well. We were all really close friends, but I was really, like I said, super burnout on rock music, on alternative rock, guitar rock, whatever you want to call it, anything mm-hmm. aggressive guitar stuff. And I felt like I felt like if I had made another record like that, I would have been phoning it in, and I'd never done anything like that in the band. And so the combination of a couple really bad record deals in a row and some poor business decisions on our part, and feeling like we were Spinal Tap combined with, you know, me not being sure what I, you know, if I still like believed in myself as a writer, all those things kind of came together. And I guess mm-hmm. that's partially why, you know, that's why we broke up, but also why I sort of blamed myself too, because, you know, if you're the front man and sort of like the de facto leader of the band, and you feel like maybe you steered the ship in the wrong direction artistically or whatever, sometimes, you know, you don't want to let people down. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I feel like I did let people down or let myself down, you know.
So, well, then looking into the future, I mean, obviously you got these Theory shows, but what else is going to be on the horizon for you then? More solo stuff?
Yeah, well, I'm definitely doing more solo stuff, and I somehow accidentally found myself in the secondary career of being a film composer, which kind of, that came out of nowhere, and I've been doing more things in that world. I had around 2011, I had a buddy who's a director was like, hey, Brett, I'm making this really small horror movie that probably nobody's going to see. And it's like $100,000 budget, no pressure, and you should score my movie. And I was like, oh, I don't know how to score a movie. And he's like, you can figure it out. If you work on it, you'll figure out, and I'll help you, and you can score this movie and figure it out.
I heard the solo record. You need some more confidence. You can do this.
Yeah, and so he basically, this is one of my best friends out here, this director, William Brent Bell, but we would always have like the greatest talks about just the creative process, and we, you know, have a few drinks and go to the bar and sit down, and he'd talk about movies, and I'd talk about music, and he'd talk about what it's like on set, and I'd talk about what it's like on tour, and we always had this like great rapport and this just cool connection talking about like the creative process. And I've always been kind of obsessed with movies and TV, and I think like he's always like just a super music fan, and so he just really believed in me and kind of had my back and was like, Brett, I think you can do this, and it's not going to be a lot of music in this movie. So long story short, end up teaming up with a friend of mine, this awesome dude named Ben Romans, and we end up kind of scoring this movie together. Really low pressure, low budget, but the movie ends up having like a bidding war with all the major studios, ends up coming out on Paramount, and it was the number one movie at the box office in America and like 40 other countries or something, and it's still to this day the biggest profit margin of any movie in the past like 15 years is this horror movie called The Devil Inside. Mm-hmm. So it literally went from, oh, I'm going to score my friend's little movie that no one's going to see that costs $100,000 or whatever, and then it ends up coming out making like $100 million and just being this sort of crazy, weird little phenomenon that mm-hmm. happens. And so that was a cool thing that kind of like opened some doors that let me... I've been doing more of that, and that kind of like changed the whole way I look at songwriting and changed the way I think about music in general, because it's such a different way of making music, and it's a different process, and it's a different collaborative system, you know, working with a filmmaker as opposed to just writing songs that you want, but making something that has to fit the picture and making something that has to tell a story, and it's not relying on the music on its own, and also learning how to use computers to make music and how to make things without a band and how to, you know, program things and figure out stuff on my own has like totally changed my whole musical perspective too. So now I'm just do a lot of that stuff and recording a bunch of different things with different people and writing pop songs and producing stuff and
awesome
figuring it out, man. That's all you can do.
Well, where can people go to learn more about you?
Oh, they can just go to my website. I don't know if it's been updated anytime in the very recent past, but I put out 2 solo records, and you can find them at brettdetter.com, I think. And there's like, there were some cool vinyls, but they're all out of press and sold out. But I got a couple other things I'm working on right now that are in the kind of like the early stages that I'm not talking about too much yet, but there's definitely some cool stuff that kind of doesn't necessarily fit into any other boxes that I've been in either. So just always making music, just always creating, and, you know, having fun.
Thanks a lot for doing this, man.
Of course, thank you.